Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Tom Weber on NPR News. Let's dive back into healthcare now. Where does the debate go from here? If there is another debate, does healthcare come up again this year? And if so, in what form? We have two guests to contemplate this, but I want to hear your questions as well. Maybe you've heard some ideas bandied about, you have questions about them, maybe you want to advocate for them. Give us a call. What do you think should be part of that debate? 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. What has the debate thus far been missing? Give us a call, 1-800-242-2828. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. Please don't call or text if you are driving. Sarah Gollest is associate professor at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health, here with me in studio. Hello, Sarah. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks so much.
Cicely Hampton is director of health policy for the group SOFI, the Society for Public Health Education. Cicely, thanks so much for your time as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Again, we'll invite your calls, 1-800-242-2828. So we're left here, Sarah, the week after. I don't know where we're going from here. What are your thoughts on the repeal vote failures, the president still wanting this to happen, and there are members of Congress working on this, but I don't know that anything is imminent here.
Yeah. So, of course, one of the lessons over the last 6 months is that it's really impossible to make predictions because it's been a really unpredictable policy and political environment. So I think Friday morning, there was a lot of commentary that repeal is dead. It's never coming back. Everyone's going to move on and find something else to do. And I don't believe that is necessarily the case. I think there are still a lot of impulses to continue the debate in the Senate. It's not clear what that would look like, mm-hmm. but there is potentially an opportunity to revive the reconciliation efforts, although it would be hard to imagine there being sufficient votes given what we saw last week. But I don't feel confident in saying that it's actually dead in the water at this point.
And maybe not, though. Maybe imminently, though. Maybe mm-hmm. this week, right? Maybe we don't talk about it this week, Cicely, right?
Well, I think that we still are talking about it this week because we have now the Problem Solvers Caucus mm-hmm. that are revealing a bill this morning with some bipartisan fixes. And so, but I think that there are, there's going to be that track where we're still going to be talking about it. But I think that there are still some in the Senate that are saying it's repeal or nothing because they've been talking about it for 7 years. They have to do what they said they were going to do for 7 years.
And I guess my point in saying that, Cicely, was that I don't see any votes at least scheduled this week, right? I mean, there may be.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, we'll have some right. policy review, unveiled here and there. But I think the Senate was going to go try to confirm a judge today. I know that there's a desire to get on to taxes and things like that. So at least there's no votes this week.
Right.
So, Sarah, what is it? So the question here, right, is the focus shifting to starting from Obamacare and fixing what's wrong with it? I mean, is that the next place to go for policy, or is it still on this idea that we get rid of things like the individual mandate, we get rid of what you have to cover and all the required essential health benefits and mm-hmm. things like that? Or is it moving to, okay, we have Obamacare, let's fix what's there?
Well, I think Cicely is right to point out that there is more motivation now than there has been around bipartisan mm-hmm. opportunities with the identification of the Problem Solvers Caucus, which is a group of 40 bipartisan members of the House of Representatives who have put forth a few strategies. Mm-hmm. But I think the debate that's looming most large right now is around the CSRs or the cost-sharing, cost-sharing reductions. Which have been held at limbo by this administration, which is creating a lot of the anxiety for insurers on the health insurance marketplace. So I think that is the key bipartisan issue that we are facing even this week.
These are payments to insurance companies between insurance companies, actually, right? Because they, if one insurance company does better and some are losing money, they kind of share the felt so that they don't lose a lot of money.
So I think what you're speaking about is reinsurance,
oh,
and that is a different thing, although also part of the bipartisan approach,
right,
that could fix Obamacare and stabilize the marketplace. The cost-sharing reductions are actually what President Trump was referring to in a series of tweets this weekend.
That he might withhold.
Yes, which he called bailouts to health insurance companies. And what they actually are payments that insurers are already legally obligated to make. So this is to reduce the burden of the expense of health care, not the premiums, but the actual daily use of health care, the deductibles, the cost sharing, the co-insurance that all Americans are subject to. And part of the Affordable Care Act was for individuals earning less than 250% of the federal poverty level, these payments would be lower. This is what's called a cost-sharing reduction. Those payments would be lower, and insurers are already making those lower for those enrollees. And what the CSRs are then the reimbursement to insurers for the payments that they've already made to reduce the burden of costs for low-income Americans.
On the point here, Cicely, about the bipartisan lawmakers, I think Jim in Stillwater has a question about this as well. Jim, go right ahead. Good morning.
Thank you very much, guys. Good show this morning. Listen, I was reading an article in Politico this morning about the bipartisan effort in the Senate of Republicans and Democrats coming together to craft some solution. So kind of a two-part question. If they eliminate the individual mandate, it reduces the pool, and the whole idea is to have a pool that's a greater entity to share those costs and spread those over. And then secondly, in terms of making those payments, is this not a revenue issue for Congress to decide? Can the president individually decide to not make payments that are the law at the end of the day?
All right. Thanks so much for that question here, Jim. And I think, Cicely, that Jim mentioned the Senate, but we should mention what you alluded to a moment ago was a bipartisan group of lawmakers in the House that will unveil some efforts here today. But let's do for Jim's second question first, Cicely. Can the president just say, I'm not going to pay those dollars, or is that something Congress can overrule him on?
So that's currently the subject of a lawsuit right now, and so that's why this whole thing is a little bit up in the air. So currently, you know, in the original Affordable Care Act, the White House essentially has been making these payments, and a group of Republican lawmakers sued the Obama administration over those payments, and that is still winding its way through the courts. And so that is why at this point President Trump and his administration feel that they have the authority to decide whether or not to make those payments. And, you know, but either way, it's going to be an issue for the court to decide, because if President Trump decides to not make this payment, people are estimating that he will immediately be faced with a lawsuit from the insurers themselves. And these cost-sharing reduction payments are actually the subject of, and who has the authority to make them or appropriate them, as Congress has the authority to do. That's actually in these bills that have come up. Even the Senate GOP bills address this issue of Congress appropriating these payments rather than them coming from the White House. So that question is a little bit up in the air right now, as we do have lawsuits currently deciding that issue and other lawsuits that will be expected to be filed if President Trump decides to not make these payments.
I mean, we're getting into civics 101, aren't we? Constitution 101, Sarah, of who appropriates the money and who actually spends it and who gets to decide if we don't spend it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the issue is that there was uncertainty in the way the original law was drafted about whether Congress has these funds appropriated already or that they have to continue to appropriate them.
I see.
So if Congress passes legislation now that clears up that uncertainty and says that these funds must be appropriated to insurers, to repaid to insurers, then that would clear it up right now.
So this sounds like one of, you know, we hear when people say fix Obamacare, there are a lot of what are referred to in legislative legalese as technical fixes. That almost sounds like the way it was worded originally could use a little bit of polishing that in another political climate would be an easily dispensed technical bill.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think if Congress wanted to act and clear up this confusion that these payments ought to be made and that they are rightfully to be made to insurers, I think that everyone would breathe a big sigh of relief. Insurers would feel a lot more certainty about operating in this marketplace. In fact, one of the reasons that insurers are describing for why they are pulling out of areas is because they have too much uncertainty about the costs of delivering health insurance in those areas because of the withholding of these important payments, which actually these are not trivial. This is $78 billion we're talking about.
And we're actually going to find out here today in Minnesota what the ballpark is for increases in healthcare premiums, especially on the individual market there. So
Yes. That
hasn't come out yet to the best of my knowledge, but stay tuned for that. For sure, we're covering that here at NPR News. Sarah Gallas with me from the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Cicely Hampton from the Society for Public Health Education, or SOFI. And we're taking your questions, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. Cicely, to Jim's earlier, Jim's other question on the phone call there was this question of whether you get rid of the individual mandate, this concept of do we get rid of the requirement that everyone has to buy insurance. That was part of some of the proposals that we saw go down last week. But Cicely, is that still on the table? Do you foresee if this healthcare conversation continues that that would still be up for potential repeal?
I do think that that is still up for debate and for repeal. The issue with that is that what you see when you manipulate the risk pools in that way, as Jim mentioned, by not requiring everyone essentially to have health insurance, is that you drive up costs tremendously because you have a situation where only people that need health insurance, i.e. the sick people or people that have some reason to believe that they will come to need health insurance in the near future, buy health insurance. And that leads to astronomical health care costs because you don't have an adequate risk pool to balance out those health care needs with people that are paying in their premiums without using those high-cost health care services. So I do think that that is still going to be part of the debate because that is something that ideologically is less palatable to conservatives who think that there should be a limited role of government. Mm-hmm. But I do think that there is, you know, there are serious issues with that because they're also wanting to increase affordability, and repealing the individual mandate is one way that you're sure to increase premiums and increase those health care costs.
Let's go back to the phones here. Pat is in Sioux Falls this morning. Pat, good morning. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Real quick prediction here. Republicans have currently a 52-48 advantage. In the 2018 round, there are a large number of Democrats up for election. I believe it's 24 Democrats and 9 Republicans. Many of those Democrats are in red states, McCaskill in Missouri, even Sherrod Brown in Ohio may not be safe. Once that election occurs, the Republicans will then have, my guess is, 56 or 57, even conceivably a 60-vote majority, and they will come back at health care and probably remove it.
Pat, thanks so much for you're talking about the Senate there, of course, Sarah. It is an electoral prediction, and we shouldn't do that. I mean, I'm not going to get into the prediction game, but I mean, I'm sure it's not impossible to think out the scenario where if the Senate holds, gain a few members, that this absolutely comes back after the 2018 election. I mean, it certainly could come back before, but I think the point there from that call is, look, that next election matters a lot, too.
Absolutely. I don't have a crystal ball, though, and so can't predict what we see after this election.
What is the conservative vision, right? We talked a lot about how the Republican bills, you know, the opposition to them, et cetera, et cetera. What is the vision for how health care within the framework of Obamacare or without should exist? Because Cicely was mentioning earlier about, you know, you have this mandate. This is the government telling you have to buy health insurance, even though actually, in its infancy, it was a conservative vision. The Heritage Foundation was actually the first organization to come out with the idea of the individual mandate. It has switched. It's not anymore. So what is the conservative vision for how this should be done?
I think you're raising a really important question and one that's at the heart of the rocky politics over the last 6 months. I think that the vision that the Republicans have been describing is one about winning and losing, winning this political game around Obamacare, and less so about putting forth a set of cohesive principles to improve the healthcare system. And so one of the challenges, I think, for gaining the votes that were lost over the last week is in that lack of a very consistent and positive message that is not just about the winning and undoing the legacy of the Affordable Care Act. I think the core principle is certainly one of freedom and personal responsibility. So the 11th hour bill that was introduced on Thursday evening, what has been called the skinny repeal bill, was called the Healthcare Freedom Act. And I think the notion of freedom that's embedded in that frame is central. It's the idea of freedom from government.
Yeah. Because it would repeal the individual mandate
and the employer mandate.
We're not going to tell you employers to you have to provide insurance
that
for your
people
employees.
Should have the option to choose not to be insured if that is their choice. Now, one of many problems with that vision is that it goes against public opinion at the moment. So while there certainly are members of the public who share that belief that the government has no role in dictating people's health insurance choices, the majority of Americans do believe at this point that the government has a role and a responsibility in the healthcare system. And so the primary messaging strategy among Republicans is not consistent with where I think the majority of Americans are at this point.
Cicely, what would you add to what Sarah just said there?
I would add that it's also fiscally irresponsible to say that, you know, it's a kind of a laissez-faire attitude around health care, because the Affordable Care Act included, you know, our first ever real mandatory funding for prevention activities in the Prevention and Public Health Fund. And so that is another thing that people don't usually talk about that was in every single one of these repeal bills. And so we are investing, you know, for the first time ever, really, in prevention. And so preventing these chronic diseases, preventing things like 100% of our national childhood-led prevention, it comes out of the Prevention and Public Health Fund. And so if you take those prevention dollars away, if you take away, you know, people's incentive to purchase health care, what you're left with is a much sicker population that then we all have to pay for. And so I think, you know, for you know, a party that, you know, talks about fiscal responsibility, you know, all the time, this is probably one of the most fiscally irresponsible things to do.
Cicely Hampton and Sarah Gallis with me here as we take your calls at 1-800-242-2828, talking about what is next, what could be next. We don't know, but we're throwing around some ideas. Again, to the point that Sarah made earlier, there are some proposals being announced today. There are some decisions coming about payments to insurance companies. And so while there won't be any scheduled votes this week in Congress on any specific bill, it is still front and center in terms of what happens on health policy here in this country. Let's go to Deborah, who's in Minneapolis. Hi, Deborah. What are your thoughts today?
Well, I think this is a perfect time to push for single-payer health care, universal health care. Over half the American population supports it, especially younger people. And I'm a retired nurse, and over my 45-year career, I watched health care become a business. And when people say that, I say, stop. When did it become a business? Should it be a business? Should people be profiting off of sick people? And I have relatives who are doctors and nurses in Scandinavia, and they're just appalled at our healthcare system. I don't know how many times I talked with patients who were crying because they couldn't afford to go to the doctor or take their child to the emergency room, or they were deciding, should I buy food or should I buy medication? You know, is healthcare a right?
Right. Or is it a privilege? Deborah, thanks so much for the call. That's a fundamental question. But is this time for single payer, Sarah?
I mean, it's certainly been discussed as a potential outcome if all of, you know, if the GOP proves unsuccessful at repealing the ACA, and or if efforts to sabotage or continue perpetuate problems in the health insurance marketplace. I don't believe it's something that we would see emerge that has enough political support in the near, you know, year or two. But I think Deborah has a point that there's a lot of people who really feel that the current healthcare system is not working. And so it's a potential political movement in the future.
And is that what we is the vehicle Medicare? Is that what we hear when people say Medicare for all? To right now, Medicare, you have to be a certain age to qualify. Is it simply to just drop that requirement and that anyone either is or could join Medicare? Is that the vehicle?
I mean, I think there are a range of policy approaches you could use
that you could get there
to get that objective.
Cicely,
and the original, the original one of the drafts back in, I think, 2008 of the what eventually became the Affordable Care Act had what we called then the trigger option. So what we're seeing now is if there were geographic locations where there was, you know, less than two insurers willing to offer insurance plans in the marketplace, that those people would have the option to buy into Medicare as an option, and that was subsequently taken out. So that is not a hard place to get to in the framework that we have today.
Yeah, I think I would just add to that and say that, a lot would be up to states in this environment. We're seeing more and more openness, and this is bipartisan openness to states being able to innovate and introduce new approaches, which could include, as Cicely mentioned, a public option, a public insurer providing competition to private insurers in certain counties.
And it's important to note there, Cicely, you're talking mostly there about the individual market, right? People who don't get insurance through their employers. We have a lot of farmers, small business people, and we've heard from them on this show about how high their premiums are and the like. And what I'm really noticing is, you know, we had, especially, well, it isn't in every state, but here in Minnesota, you had the Medicaid expansion. And so the eligibility increases for people to get into Medicaid. And then for people of a certain income and below, you have these rebates to help offset the cost of the premiums. So then you have people who make just too much, who make just a little bit more than that, and they are not eligible for any of these, and they're socked with these high premiums. And I would argue, Cicely, these people are solidly in the middle class, or maybe they don't consider themselves in the middle class, but maybe the actuaries will put them in the middle class. And they're the ones seeing just the absolute highest rates right now. Are we seeing proposals out there to target specifically that population of people on the individual market to give them relief? As we see these bipartisan groups come together, are those people the focus? Cicely?
Yes and no.
Yes and no.
And so that would be where the repeal of the individual mandate comes in, because there is a recognition of that group of people that you're talking about. I think it's estimated around, 4 million people or so. The problem is that these proposals are using, a really blunt instrument. So in order to, help the 4 million people that find themselves in that coverage gap that you described, they're willing to take away healthcare, from 22 to 32 million people in order to help those, that small slice of Americans that make too much to be eligible for subsidies, but are in areas where the premiums are really high. And so I think that there are ways that are much better to do that, to specifically target that group of people where you're not also taking healthcare away from, 22 to 32 million other people.
What do you see, Sarah? What would be the fix for those I mean, do you just increase the rebates? Do you just increase the eligibility for the rebates? I mean, what are the fixes?
Well, certainly, you know, increasing the level of the premiums and tax credits would help. Mm-hmm. I think there are a variety of other fixes that could help people who are essentially making too much to get the support as currently constructed in the Affordable Care Act. Caps on the amount a premium can be out of someone's total income at 8-9% would help.
Oh, I see.
It's harder to imagine the political support for or the bipartisan support for that type of strategy right now, given that in the Senate Better Care Reconciliation Act, the subsidies that were and tax credits that were offered in that replacement package were for people earning even less. They were for people earning 350% of the federal poverty level. So I think you're right to point out that this is that's a very difficult population. So I think that the approaches are more likely to be ones that are to stabilize the broader insurance marketplace in general through what we talked about, through cost sharing reduction payments and through reinsurance strategies that could help insurers keep prices, keep premium prices down for everyone.
Let's go to Peggy, who's on the phone in Jordan. Hi, Peggy. Go right ahead.
Hey, of course we have to have an individual mandate. We all have to pay into it. And my point is, I think is a really good idea. Let's remind everybody how we all have to pay into auto insurance. And that's the thing nobody even bats an eye at. It's a given. So if they were to kind of change the message and bring this into the conversation and just say, hey, calm down, guys.
Yeah.
This is a reality, and it's we're already doing it, so we got to do it now here, too.
Peggy, thanks for the call. I think your bird wanted to get in there as well on the conversation, and I appreciate that. But, Cicely, is that a talking point? Is that the talking point to say, well, we have to do it for car insurance because if we're out there driving without insurance and we get in a wreck, everyone has to pay for the cost of that. Is that the talking point to then transition that to healthcare?
No, I don't think that resonates with people at this point. And while, you know, and this debate has been less than logical, as we'll say, because, you know, you've mentioned, you know, though that slice of America that is, you know, making too much to get the subsidies, but their insurance premiums are really high. And so the answer to that is to just repeal the whole thing, whereby they're not eligible for any subsidies at all. So how does that make sense? It doesn't. And so, you know, Sarah has done a good job of talking about the politics versus the policy of this. And I think that if we were having, you know, hearings and a transparent process, we would have gotten, you know, better talking points and we would have gotten to a rational place. But right now, we've not been having, at least for the past 7 months, a very rational discussion about real policy solutions. We have been focused on the politics of repealing the Affordable Care Act because that was a campaign promise.
I think, and I would just add on to that, that I think that one thing that's been revealed to me is how little people understand the purpose of health insurance, the idea that as a community, we all buy in and that if the healthy pay to be in as part of the risk pool that helps the sick be able to afford their premiums. I think the basic idea that there is a community responsibility and that that's the very nature of having insurance has not been communicated well. We heard that throughout the months of these repeal and replace discussions about raising questions like, why should I have to pay for maternity care if I'm a man or if I'm a woman who doesn't intend to have children? And I think questions like that belie a lack of understanding of how we as a society should be part of a common community, and we cover health insurance. We have a responsibility. I agree with the caller on that. I think that the analogy of car insurance and fire insurance doesn't work because people like to believe that healthcare is different, that there's something exceptional about health insurance. And because it's for most people is a private purchase, there's just it just doesn't that analogy just isn't clear.
Well, and you also note about where people don't necessarily get the concept of insurance, that you need the healthy and the sick in this to make this work, that we are in this together. And yet it's privately run. These are private companies that are coming in for their own criticism for the salaries that the CEOs make. And I have a couple tweets here that we should stop insurance companies from being able to lobby Congress. Mm-hmm. And frankly, an insurance company, this non, you know, this thing, right, is an easy target. So how do we rectify the fact that even though it's private, the concept is that we're in this together, and yet the insurance companies come in for the bad rap?
Oh, I agree with you. That's a fundamental tension with our healthcare system.
So you don't have any magic solution for me. You're not going to
afraid not at
you're
the
not going to fix it all. Cicely, do you want to get in on that?
Well, I would just say that, you know, people try to compare where we are as a nation to the Scandinavian countries, and you know, the red line in the sand there is the insurance companies. And so, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, an apples to apples comparison. Even when people talk about, you know, having a public option or, you know, universal health care, you know, what they're talking about there is, you know, so how do you deal with the entrenched interests, i.e. the insurance companies? And, mm-hmm. you know, and that's kind of where the conversation stops.
You know, there is that group, Sarah, of bipartisan lawmakers, House Republicans and Democrats. The word is they might well release today their idea. We haven't seen it yet. We've been on the air here. But in some of the reporting about it, it has listed some generalities of what mm-hmm. they're going for, including answering and clarifying this question about paying the insurance companies, where Donald Trump is withholding statements. I think that's actually a pretty simple fix, at least in terms of the language you put on a piece of paper. So stabilize those markets in that respect now. But there's also ideas around there. So right now, if a company has at least 50 workers, they have to provide health insurance. This plan would bump it up to 500. So you have to have 500 people. So for example, I actually think right here at Minnesota Public Radio, I don't think we've reached 500. I don't think we have 500. I have to check with that. So we would come out of that requirement. I think, though, you could make the argument that a place like NPR would want to still offer it because it's a benefit for hiring people. There's also a federal stability fund that they might create here, dollar amount unknown, that states tap to reduce premiums. That sounds a lot like what the state of Minnesota did earlier this year, exactly. But that this would be a federal pot of money to tap as well. And get rid of the medical device tax. That's always in the crosshairs. Big implications here in Minnesota here as well. More flexibility for state innovation as well. More waivers and let the states figure out how to do it. Those are the general ideas I've seen on this bipartisan. Is that a good bill? Is that a bill worth taking forward?
I think there's a lot of it's certainly worth a discussion. Mm-hmm. And I would hope that that discussion would happen in a procedural way that's different from what we have seen from the House and Senate plans. I think one of the very fair critiques that has been made about what we've seen over the last few months was that the process in the Senate and the House was, I think, worth a lot of critique.
Yeah. Didn't go through hearings
yes,
the normal way.
Bills were drafted in secret. They were drafted by, at least in the Senate, by a group of all-male senators. That they didn't have the normal hearings that the that we expect to see, that there wasn't a lot of public participation in the process. And so I think that the four ideas that you just described are certainly worth considering, and I would hope that they would be discussed in a more typical fashion.
And I know, Cicely, Democrats have wanted to focus a lot on drug prices as well and changing some of the policy there to bring down the cost of drugs. But in our last minute, Cicely, as we wrap up here, what of this initial outline from this bipartisan group? Is that a good place to start?
I think at this point,
anything is good.
Anything is a place to start. That has, you know, bipartisan support. So we've done. We've changed the date of implementation on the medical device tax. That's something that has bipartisan support. So that's absolutely something that should be in there. The, you know, changes to the state innovation waivers to make those easier to use, because we have seen a lot of innovation coming out of the state. That's a good place to start. I'm not as sure about the changes to the employer mandate, because the majority of Americans work for employers with less than 500 right. employees. So who does this touch, and how does that affect, you know, people that have insurance going forward? But anything that's bipartisan that is committed to regular order is a great place to start at this point.
Cicely Hampton, Director of Health Policy for the Society for Public Health Education, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Sarah Gallis, Professor at the University of Minnesota's School of Public Health. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
More online at mprnews.org.